that funding to force compliance. UC Provost Catherine Newman says they're investing more money, but part of the challenge is finding experts to assist.
It's actually not easy to find those folks. There are some very technical requirements.
We're the qualified people.
Lee Sisko, tribal member of the Santa Rosa Rancheria Tachi Yukot tribe.
We're the expert in this field because those are our ancestors.
He spoke with California Assemblyman James Ramos of the Serrana Cahuilla tribe, who says repatriation will help Native Americans heal from the state's historical wrongs.
Those remains do carry connections to our people, and it's not until they're properly reburied that healing can start to take place from a traumatic experience that our people suffered from the history of the state of California.
Christina Onnestad, California National Native News.
Earlier this week, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals blocked a land swap that would hand a swath of the Tonto National Forest, a parcel sacred to Native Americans, over to a multinational mining company. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, President Trump has weighed in.
On Truth Social, Trump blamed a radical left court for delaying the swap, which would clear the way for a massive mine run by Resolution Copper.
Trump is blatantly attempting to strong-arm the court.
Adelita Grijalva says his rhetoric is reckless, dangerous, and even corrupt. She's running to fill the seat of her father, the late Arizona Congressman Raul, who spent his political career trying to stop mining in the area known as Oak Flat. Trump called those who oppose the mine anti-American.
Trump can try to shame us. We're not going to be silenced. For him to call us all anti-American for standing up to protect Oak Flat, it's not just wrong, it's offensive. Standing up for our communities, our land, and our future is the most American thing that we can do. And we're going to continue to do that.
Resolution Copper is owned by foreign mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP.
It's no surprise to see this president side with foreign corporations over America's natural resources, and less for having any kind of consideration of tribal leaders and land.
San Carlos Apache Chairman Terry Rambler believes Trump has been misinformed by Resolution Copper's supporters, even offering to sit down with the president and share, quote, factual information to protect American assets. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 21st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Hannah Francis,
Josh Salem,
James Kemp,
Mel Gertoff, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One.
The interim director of Evening News is Hannah Francis.
A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Europe and the Arab states seek a Gaza settlement, but Netanyahu wants total victory. After the Alaska summit, where things stand, and U.S.-China trade talks are extended. First, Europe and the Arab states seek a Gaza settlement, but Netanyahu wants total victory. European leaders are just as disenchanted with Donald Trump's policy on Israel as they are with his Ukraine policy. So they're trying to do something about it, spurred on by Israel's starvation of the Palestinian population. The Europeans, mainly Starmer of Britain, Macron of France, and Merz of Germany, circulated an 8-point peace plan, which was followed by a declaration signed by 22 Arab nations that reflected French and Saudi diplomatic efforts over several months. The declaration says, quote, Hamas must end its rule in Gaza and hand over its weapons to the Palestinian Authority with international engagement and support, unquote. This is the first time Arab nations have called for Hamas to be disarmed and give up power in Gaza. The European plan, according to a New York Times report, calls for, quote, a technocratic Palestinian government for Gaza linked to a reformed Palestinian Authority, an international security force, a full withdrawal by Israel, U.S.-led monitoring of the ceasefire, and ultimately two independent states, unquote. Separately, Germany declared an arms embargo on Israel, and France and the United Kingdom have announced plans to recognize a Palestinian state. Despite all these efforts, the parties agree that the Trump administration must sign on to a peace plan. There's no sign that Trump will do anything contrary to Netanyahu's wishes, however. The Israeli government is putting Gaza under siege and plans to annex both it and the West Bank. To emphasize the point, Netanyahu said on Israeli television that he subscribes to the vision of a greater Israel, a vision that goes beyond the occupied lands to encompass portions of neighboring countries. Arab countries uniformly condemned Netanyahu's remark. Huge crowds in Tel Aviv demanding an end to the war are unlikely to affect his planning either. What will become of the Palestinian population if Gaza is formally occupied? Two possibilities have emerged. One, as reported by The Guardian, calls for moving the population of Gaza City, about 1 million people, somewhere to the south. Quote, the Israeli military will begin preparing for the forcible displacement of Palestinians from Gaza City. Gaza residents will be provided with tents and other shelter equipment to ensure their safety, the Israeli military claimed. It did not say when the mass displacement would begin. The second option is even more outrageous. Removal of the population to Africa. Following a visit to Israel by South Sudan's foreign minister, Reuters reports, discussions are ongoing about moving Palestinians to that country, which is in the midst of a humanitarian crisis. Israel, South Sudan, and the U.S. all denied or disclaimed knowledge of this idea, while Palestinian authorities condemned any deportation of the population. After the Alaska summit, where things stand. First of all, the Trump administration is saying nothing about sanctions on Russia for its refusal to accept a ceasefire in Ukraine. Remember that Trump had said, I won't be happy if I walk away without some form of a ceasefire. That was before the summit. Now he accepts Putin's plan for moving directly into peace talks. President Zelensky is firm about the need for a ceasefire, as are European leaders. Otherwise, Russia will keep bombing and taking over territory, which is exactly what it is doing right now. Trump is still thinking about forcing Ukraine to trade peace for land, which would mean ceding about 20% of Ukrainian territory in the east in return for security guarantees. Russia would freeze the line of control of its forces, but this is not a swap, as Trump would put it, because Russia would not be giving up any of its own territory. As for security guarantees for Ukraine, Steve Witkoff, Trump's special envoy, said that Putin had agreed to a game-changing concession that would allow the U.S. to provide security guarantees modeled after NATO's Article 5, the crucial collective defense part of the NATO treaty. But Trump has ruled out a U.S. peacekeeping force in Ukraine, whereas British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has said that Ukraine is on an irreversible path to membership in NATO. In any case, there is no evidence that Putin has conceded on some kind of a NATO role in protecting Ukraine. To the contrary, Russia's foreign minister said just the other day that Russia itself will insist on being a security guarantor in Ukraine. The Europeans immediately responded that that idea was absurd. As for Ukraine, its idea of security guarantees must include having at least some NATO forces stationed in Ukraine. Ukrainians recall that in 1994, in the so-called Bucharest Memorandum, they received robust promises to respect Ukraine's territory, including from Russia. only to have Russia seize parts of Donbas and the Crimea. Finally, peace talks are scheduled to move into a second phase, but whether or not this brings together Putin and Zelensky is very much in doubt. Even if they do meet, these talks are likely to be lengthy and very complicated. Russian and Ukrainian interests are so far apart, for example, on Ukraine's future security, Russian war reparations and boundaries, that a credible agreement is hard to conceive. In all, looking back at this summit, it was a disaster for the U.S., for Trump's presidency, and for Ukraine. A second round of talks looks just as bad, especially as it appears that Russia's position has not changed one iota with respect to Ukraine's independence and Russia's territorial ambitions. Next, U.S.-China trade talks are extended. August 12th was the deadline for a U.S.-China trade agreement. It didn't happen. Trump agreed to a 90-day extension while negotiators continued their work. Absent an agreement, the current 30% tariff on Chinese goods would have been raised sky high, and likewise China's 10% tariff on U.S. goods. Among the issues that divide the two sides are China's desire for more advanced AI chips and the U.S. desire for more Chinese agricultural purchases. Trump wants a quadrupling of China's purchases of U.S. soybeans and fewer Chinese purchases of Russian and Iranian oil. On the Chinese side, however, voices are being raised about the quality of the NVIDIA chips, specifically that they are, quote, not technologically advanced or environmentally friendly. Chinese authorities worry that the chips may have a backdoor, making them a security risk. One other China-related news of note, President Trump says that President Xi Jinping assured him that China would not invade Taiwan during Trump's tenure. "He told me," said Trump on Fox News, "I will never do it as long as you're president. President Xi told me that, and I said, well, I appreciate that. But he also said, but I am very patient and China is very patient." When that conversation supposedly happened is not clear. If it did happen, it would be unprecedented for a Chinese leader to rule out liberating Taiwan without a firm assurance from the United States that it will stop arming or diplomatically supporting Taiwan. Trump's rendering of this conversation may be fake news. In other news, the Israeli military demolishes a food connection between Israelis and Palestinians. The Palestinian National Seed Bank collects and preserves heirloom seeds of crops and plants that are critical to people's food supply. Each year, the Palestinian Bank provides free seeds to hundreds of agricultural workers to promote the preservation of the genetic diversity of some 80 traditional varieties. The seeds have cultural as well as nutritional value. On July 31st, Israeli military forces bulldozed one of the two branches of the seed bank in the West Bank. Its structures, irrigation system, seed collection, putting the seasonal harvest at risk and threatening the seed supply to farmers. A reporter for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which published this news, wrote, quote, "It's hard to fault those who claim that the destruction of this agricultural facility is part of a deliberate policy of the State of Israel," unquote. Might this also be considered an act of cultural genocide? The seed bank connects Palestinians in the West Bank to Israel proper. The West Bank farmers who grow the fruits, vegetables, and legumes have, over the past two decades, made their way to top Tel Aviv restaurants, often via direct shipments from wholesale market traders in East Jerusalem, and they're the very same farmers who stand to be harmed by the destruction of the Palestinian National Seed Bank. The Israeli Defense Forces evidently paid no heed to this connection. Finally, this story from Vietnam, where farmers are being removed to make way for a Trump golf resort. The socialist government of Vietnam isn't behaving like one when it comes to dealing with the Trump organization. It is bulldozing land and displacing farmers to make way for a $1.5 billion Trump golf resort in a partnership between the Trump organization and a Vietnamese real estate company. Farmers are being given a pittance in compensation. So now we know why Trump reduced the tariff rate on Vietnamese exports from 46% to 20%, and why the Vietnamese government rushed through approvals of the project, bypassing a number of environmental and other regulations. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
K- KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
There have been many calls for action coming from the UN and various nation states, as well as activists and non-governmental organizations all over the world, in the midst of widespread reports of starvation in Gaza due to US-backed Israeli blockades. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Eric Rubin of People Against Genocide Everywhere and Delinda Hanley of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs about a proposal for an armed force to go into Gaza to put an end to the Israeli assault on the Palestinian territory.
This would be kind of something new. And what would this look like? Either one of you who wants to handle this, an actual armed force in Gaza, not Israeli, not U.S., but a multinational force. Would this be a part of something the U.N. would do, or would it just be individual countries getting together to come up with a combined force?
So basically, we've been working with Craig Bookhiver, who many folks know is an amazing individual. He's been with the U.N. for decades, and he had quit because of the inability of the U.N. to do anything to stop the genocide. And he brought our attention to the Uniting for Peace resolution. What that entails is basically overriding the Security Council. With the Security Council, you would have the blue hats, the peacekeepers. This is fundamentally different. This would be the General Assembly having a vote to bring in Uniting for Peace resolution. That resolution, and there have been actually two since the beginning of October 7th, but with no teeth, basically saying Israel bad, Gaza good. And that was it. The problem has been there are no teeth in it. So this one has, we have specific and very, very clear components of what we want to see in the resolution. At which point, if two-thirds of the General Assembly then agree, what happens is the various countries within the UN then bring in and decide what kind of forces they want to bring in. Troops, ships, planes. These are defensive forces, and they would be used both to stop the genocide in Gaza and also to open up all the humanitarian routes to the UN without any interference by the US or by Israel.
Delinda, has there been any precedent for this? Have armed troops gone into an area with teeth, as you're putting it?
Yes, in Egypt, it worked to prevent the Suez crisis. There have been armed troops in Lebanon trying to keep the two sides from killing each other. And may I also stress that Palestinians would be able to help figure out what nationalities are part of the troops, right, Eric? Like, they probably don't want Americans, and but, you know, South Africans, Australians, I mean, Irish would be wonderful troops. They get to help select because it's protecting them.
Yes, I think the thing that people need to realize, because I talk to people all the time, and they're like, we never heard of this. Well, actually, nor did I until, you know, Craig Bookhiver was kind enough to share it. The fact of the matter is, as Delinda was saying, not only has it been done before, but interesting enough, it's been done by the U.S. before. And, you know, it was instituted specifically to override Security Council vetoes. And the U.S. has used that mechanism when it was of their interest, but then denied it even existed historically at this point. So just wanted to add that little caveat there, if I may.
So if you're talking about a Suez Canal type situation, the Eisenhower administration just didn't want to allow the British, French, and Israelis to take over the Suez Canal. The U.S. is sitting on top of the world at the time and had the power to do that. But in this situation, the U.S. is totally with the Israelis. So is that going to make a difference if a multinational armed force starts to come in and the U.S. and the Israelis oppose it? What will happen then?
I mean, I think Israel has pretty much shown what it will do. The question is, to what extent will they do that before they stop or are stopped doing it? And the fact that it's an armed defensive group that's being sent in there is for a reason. Israel has shown total disregard for international law. They've shown total disregard for human rights, for life. They've killed professors, they've killed healthcare workers, they've killed UN workers unarmed. So I think anyone that has the belief that this would be, you know, Israel would see the armed troops and hold their hands up and sing kumbaya, is somewhat naive. But at the same time, I think the flip side of that is that without it, we're looking at probably 1.8 million people in Gaza that are still alive, either being exterminated or expelled. So yes, they will not give in most probably easily, although there's always the hope that they would. And the fact that this is a defensive force, I think, is a critical component to make people aware of as well.
So if this kind of operation should succeed, would that be a precedent for situations like Yemen and Sudan and the Congo and Myanmar, do you think?
I think it would be a precedent in multiple ways.
I agree. It would give the UN teeth and in all these decisions. They're trying to do the right thing, and then the US blocks it or Russia blocks it. The Security Council makes the UN just powerless, toothless, and Israel just ignores things, every resolution that the UN does squeeze through. So we need to give some strength and teeth.
Yeah, I think countries would always make the national sovereignty argument. You don't have the right to do this in our country, that kind of thing.
And we're doing it in Palestine. They do have the right. And this petition has been sent to the PLO ambassador to the UN. We've sent a letter that we want to send to the UN for approval. The UN, I mean, Palestine would have a say, this is their land.
Any support in the U.S. Congress for this kind of plan?
I'm trying to think if any Congress people have signed it. I'm not sure.
And what about the EU? Some of the countries seem to make noise once in a while about the tragedy, but they don't really take action.
I just want to say so many people from the entire world have signed this petition. They want their countries to take action.
This is the beginning. We're basically in every country where there's protest. It's a matter of refocusing the protest and with specific demands, which we are very clear on. And it's a phase thing. The first thing has to be done is one country has to call in the General Assembly for a emergency meeting. That's simple. Pick up the phone, call. Within that 24 hours, and all the General Assembly members will then meet. We have put together with Craig Bocheiber a very clear list of what needs to be within that resolution, the Uniting for Peace resolution, and that at every country, people need to be focusing their energy on the federal building, saying this is what we want in it. Once that is done, then the critical thing is what is each country going to contribute? Because that was getting back to, I believe, your initial question. That point, again, it's the relationship between the people, the millions on the street, and the government and every government has their own internal conflicts to make sure that, you know, okay, so Spain, what are you going to give? The people in Spain are going to ask, you know, are you going to give, we have a battleship. You want to give them a battleship? Let's bring a battleship in. How about 5,000 troops? And at that particular juncture, you see the formation of this process coming together. But at every juncture, the pressure must be coming from the people in the streets and putting that pressure with a clear distinction of what needs to be done, at which point the possibility of it happening becomes real.
What about some of the trade relations these countries have with Israel? Will that affect their decision about whether to get involved in this?
I would think they would be able to stop weapons transfers and, you know, do some boycotting at this point too, if Israel is ignoring UN resolutions and this.
You don't think they would think, well, we don't want to lose this relationship. This is economically beneficial, and regardless of the number of people in the streets in our country, we can't do this. Do you think that would be the thinking of some of these countries?
I mean, I think economically, we're sending so much money to Israel in military aid. It's a win for us. We could save a lot of money. In our current issue of the Washington Report, we're paying way more than $3.8 billion a year. We spent an extra $17.9 billion during Biden's administration during this war. The cost of all these U.S. interventions is huge. I mean, it's a win if we say, okay, halt this war, and we won't send you money. And that would really make Prime Minister Netanyahu listen.
I remember hearing that a 30-second phone call from Biden to Netanyahu could have ended the whole thing early on. And he didn't do it.
I mean, isn't it fascinating that Biden created this, allowed it to be to continue, financed it, funded it? Donald Trump comes in and continues the tradition. And if you look in Congress, it's one of the few bipartisan things that they hold hands and they agree upon, which is continuing the genocide in Gaza, supporting Israel. The question of trade, though, I'd like to speak to that. I used to be the director of something called the Florida Fair Trade Coalition. And trade has always been the flip side of war. What they can't do in trade, if it doesn't work, it's usually send the troops in. And in this particular case, I think if you look at the Hague group, that there already has been some very clear demarcations as to what those countries, I think what there were 13 countries. I was actually there for those 2 days, not with inside the ministerial, and the other 30 plus countries that were there as guests are talking about. The moment that they begin to seriously stop doing the trading, the historical precedent for the United States has always been, you don't trade with us, we'll bomb you. You don't let us have our exploitation for however we want to do that for those who pay our paychecks, we'll bomb you. Well, that's kind of a different situation now. And I think because of that, you know, when Francesca put forward the question of economics, it holds a lot of meat. But that's a long-term issue. Right now, we're talking about within 2 months, within a month perhaps, 1.8 million people in Gaza may be exterminated.
And I keep hearing the 14,000 babies may die figure. You think that's pretty accurate?
I think it's probably accurate. I think it's on the end. I mean, I have friends that live in Gaza, who are Palestine. I'm watching people right now. And I think for people who don't know this, you know, I'm watching somebody. It's costing, I think, like $500 for a pound of flour at this point. And I have a friend who's a professor who's there with his 2 kids and his 2 nieces because they themselves, they lost their parents because of the genocide. He is feeding his children. And every day I look at him, he's becoming more and more gaunt, as his kids are, as his nieces, nephews are as well. This is a genocide. This is not a famine. This is a forced starvation. The only question I think should be on people's minds right now is what can we do at this moment to stop the genocide, to open up the humanitarian aid immediately before another child dies from starvation, before another person dies from a bomb landing on their tent. And I mean, I think that has to be the urgent call for everyone out there who's opposed to this genocide right now, is what can we do in a concrete way to stop this genocide tomorrow? The Uniting for Peace proposal is something tangible, and it can be implemented within a 2-week period or less.
Are you at all encouraged by some of the people in Israel, like Ehud Olmert, talking about how Israel is committing war crimes? Does that matter at all? I mean, we know people like Gideon Levy will speak out, but Israeli establishment figures, is that significant?
Speaking of Gideon Levy, he's got a wonderful article in today's Haaretz about this. It's describing the pictures of babies dying of starvation that Israel's criminal local media isn't talking about. It's hiding. And he said, their lack of coverage of Gaza will never be forgotten or forgiven. And we're seeing it in the rest of the year, but rest of the world, but Israelis aren't seeing it. And he writes, these are pictures reminiscent of concentration camp survivors, pictures from the Holocaust. Concealing them is akin to denial of the phenomenon, turning deliberate starvation into a legitimate and acceptable weapon among Israelis. And he concludes, there's only one thing that is worse than deliberate starvation, and that's indifference with which it's received in Israel, and I would also add in the United States. An hour and a half away from Israel by car is the location of a baby who died on Wednesday. His family couldn't find any milk substitute for him. While he died, Channel 12 in Israel was broadcasting a cooking show, and the ratings were excellent.
And what about in this country, people like Tom Friedman, for example, a staunch supporter of Israel, coming out and saying Israel is no longer an ally of the United States as far as he's concerned? Is that going to resonate with some of the other Israel supporters?
I think that every time that someone who has been supportive of Israel learns the truth and then speaks that truth, that it changes the paradigm a little bit more. So, you know, thank goodness for that. And I think that all of that helps. Ultimately, though, ultimately, I think that the only thing, and I think that, you know, this is one of the things that, Craig Mochaber has also said, fundamentally, it will only change, not out of the good intentions of people, not out of the good intentions of corporations, not out of the moral decency of people or governments, but when they are forced by the people of their country to stand up to do the right thing. And, you know, I mean, we've had so much energy. Sadly, a good portion of it has just been fundamentally misplaced. You know, when you're chanting Free Palestine, that's wonderful. But what are you going to do to free them? When you're saying stop the genocide, what are you saying that we need to do to stop the genocide now? And I think that's why what we've seen, and when I was in at the Hague meeting, and I was talking to people and saying, there is something we can do. This uniting for peace. This is real. This is tangible. We need to make our countries do this. It was like people looked at me and was like, the first thing is like, are you for real? You know, how come we haven't heard of this for 22 months? That's a damn good question, you know? But yes, it is real. And it is something that can be implemented. And it has to be from the grassroots. Within 2 weeks, to give an example, we expect 30 countries of people's movements. When we say people's movements, you've heard of the overland, the two caravans overland, you've heard of the flotillas. These are the groups that have come on board initially. These are the groups who have virtually said, we have been doing what we can symbolically. Now we could do something objectively tangible as well. And that is the heart and soul of the majority of the people out here who have been protesting, or even just sitting in front of their television or their computer crying and saying, what can I do? You can get out there. I would recommend
KBOO Portland.
Our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive is coming. Tune in August 20th, where we'll bring you testimonials, anecdotes, facts, and more all day long to celebrate National Radio Day. KBOO, made by